Welcome to New York Parent Attorney Perspectives, podcast number 2. This podcast is brought to you by the New York State Office of Indigent Legal Services. One of our hosts today is Angela Burton, the Director of Quality Enhancement for Parental Representation, and I am Lucy McCarthy from New York State Defenders Association, the Family Court Staff Attorney there. We have a special guest today from Hiscock Legal Aid Society. We'll introduce them in a moment, but we're here to talk about the administrative directive that was issued late last year, 17 OCFS ADM 14, which is the directive that talks about parenting time between parents and children and other visitation with other kin. That was addressed in our first podcast, and we're here to discuss it more. We are joined by Amanda McHenry and Nancy Farrell from Hiscock Legal Aid Society. Nancy is the supervising attorney there, and Amanda is
the assistant supervising attorney.
Mm-hmm. The assistant supervising attorney at Hiscock Legal Aid. And we're going to be talking to them about how they've addressed the issue of parenting time in their courts. But first, I wanted to ask each of you why you think it's so important to establish concrete parenting plans and goals and objectives with regard to the time that our clients spend with their kids.
Sure. So it's so important to establish concrete parenting time for our clients because obviously this is a very distressing time for them. They have a lot going on. A lot of time they're engaged in different services, and they can't really see the light at the end of the tunnel. And if they know every single week, or hopefully often, more often than that, what date, what time, when they're going to see their children, that they're not going to be, you know, kind of left out in the cold, and they're still going to have contact that's meaningful with them, that really gives them hope throughout the remainder of the case. And obviously it's also extremely important for the child, because the child is, this is the only person they've ever lived with most of the time, the only parent they've ever known. And so it's just as traumatic, if not more traumatic, for the child. And it's really important to try and obtain parenting time between, obviously, sibling, or to ensure sibling contact, parent-child contact, and contact not just with parents, but I would say also with other people that may be in their life, an aunt, uncle, friend, teacher, to kind of maintain that normalcy for all parties involved.
And jumping off of that, I think that one of the reasons it's so important, Amanda talked about the trauma. There's trauma to the children, and that's what we hear about most in the courts. But there's also trauma to our clients when their children are removed from them. And we have to remember that until it's established otherwise and our clients say otherwise, the goal is return to parent. And the studies show that the most important thing to reaching that goal, especially in a quick fashion, is to have that concrete set parenting time plan, and to have it as frequently as possible, and to have it in the most natural setting. And so for those reasons, you know, it's so important for attorneys to not lose sight of that fact, especially in the beginning when we're looking at imminent risk hearings. And your first priority, you know, is, do we have an imminent risk hearing or don't we? And if you do, you know, you're focused on all of the reasons why you're trying to keep the child in the home, that sometimes we lose sight of that second piece, because then our clients become distraught when the court says that they're going to be removing the children. And so establishing that concrete parenting plan from the beginning and establishing a very strong one gives your client the best, I guess, jumping off point to getting their children back in the home.
And can I just also ask you to elaborate a little bit on the sort of special case where it involves a newborn, particular issues that one would want to pay close attention to in those types of cases?
Sure. So obviously with newborns, sometimes the removal of the child is based off of possible substance use, the child testing positive, mom testing positive, and that can sometimes be a huge hindrance to contact moving forward. And if that's not an issue, and our clients say they're breastfeeding, we want to push that they still be able to do that for the child. So we're pushing for daily contact if possible. With newborns, there's a lot of studies showing that there's different chemical releases when you breastfeed and when you can smell your parent, hear your parent's voice, feel their touch, and that's really crucial to creating that bond in the beginning. So with newborns, we're really pushing very strong and very hard for as frequent contact and for as long as of a period as possible.
And you've got to remember too that with newborns, we don't just represent, although more frequently it's the mother, but we also represent fathers who have newborns. And the mother has the benefit of that personal relationship of that child she's growing within her. And the fathers don't necessarily have that benefit. And so the bond between them at this stage is so crucial, especially if you're going to be continuing to encourage your client to fight for this child that they haven't yet, maybe not even held.
Okay. And kind of routing back to the directive a little bit. So what was it, you learned about this late last year. And what was the first course of action that you took when you learned about the directive?
Well, when we learned about the directive, we read the directive and kind of went through it and applied it to what's been already happening in our county. You know, what kind of things in this directive are they already doing? What are we arguing for? So kind of looking at it in a sense of evaluating and grading the county on where they've already met the directive, and laying out what we hope to see come from the directive.
Was there anything that was surprising in the directive for you that you were happy about, you were pleased about
seeing?
There was
a lot that I was pleased about. One thing that typically the exact opposite happens is when a child is in some sort of, not just trauma, but when they're having some sort of episode, whether it be mental health or they're ill and they're in the hospital, a lot of the times our clients don't get to go up to the hospital and see the child or go and see them when they're held in a mental health agency because they're afraid that maybe the parent's going to trigger something when in fact the exact opposite typically is what's going to happen. They're going to have that person that they're used to that they want to see. Possibly even the fact that they're separated from that person is why they're ill or why something is happening. So I was very happy to see that there is a push, a huge push, for an increase in time when a child's going through some sort of crisis like that. So that was something I was very impressed with and very happy with.
Okay.
It was nice to see it in paper because
yes,
it's arguments that we've made, but it was nice having it written in this directive. The other thing, too, is just the discussion about the child remaining as close as possible to where the parent resides. All too frequently, we have clients whose kids are placed outside of our county, and that adds so many challenges to parenting time, to services, and increased parenting time. The other thing, too, is that, you know, the county resources and finances cannot be the only consideration when considering how much parenting time should be ordered for that parent. And then also just how much it addresses that the statute that describes the minimum amount of parenting time, that biweekly, that it's stressed in there that is minimum. That really parenting time should be in the most natural setting. It should not start off as supervised unless there are clear reasons for it to start off supervised. And it was nice to see that in there because, again, that's another thing that we battle at imminent risk hearings all the time, is it is just automatically assumed it's a supervised parenting time, and it's in a very sterile setting.
Right. Well, that's, the directive calls for the local DSS to call, you know, have these planning meetings to put together a written policy that was to be issued by January 3rd, I believe it was. Were you invited by your local DSS to start planning?
I can't say that we were, no. Okay. However, I will say that recently when we asked for what the policy that they had put together, because that was due, you know, in January, when we asked for the policy, we were provided with a draft policy, and the deputy commissioner in our county explained to me that they have put this together and they're working on finalizing it, and that we have a subcommittee of our stakeholders group that is supposed to be working on finalizing it, and I was invited to partake in that group to finalize the policy for Onondaga County. But at this time, we do not have a finalized policy.
Okay, in terms of other counties that maybe haven't had a chance to perfect their policy, I was thinking that maybe some of our other stakeholders can reach out and talk to their commissioners and try to have a discussion.
Absolutely.
With their DSS counterparts.
I would encourage people to reach out. If they have not already been provided this policy, there's a good possibility that caseworkers haven't been provided the policy, that parents haven't been provided the policy. So as practicing parent defense attorneys, I would say make it your obligation to reach out to the commissioner, the deputy commissioner, whoever you think is responsible for putting this out in your county to get that. And I would encourage people to distribute it amongst your colleagues and
have a discussion about what works.
Well, this is Angela, and I just wanted to add on to that one of the reasons that the directive included an instruction to the counties to develop a written policy that embodies the principles of the directive is so that there's transparency for parents, for foster parents, for attorneys, and everyone involved about what the expectations are with respect to parenting time, and so that whatever the written policy is that's developed, and your involvement out there in podcast land should actually try to help ensure that the policy that is distributed to parents and others is in a manner that is understandable, that has the expectations very clear, because it's really a matter of trying to make sure that people are all on the same page about what the expectations are.
And I think it's important to note, Angela, and I think that we talked about this a little bit in podcast one, but essentially there's actually nothing new in this administrative directive. All of this is contained within the regulations and policy of the Office of Children and Family Services already. It's kind of encapsulated into one. The one thing that is clarified is what is meant by biweekly, that really is the bare minimum in terms of how often parents should see their kids. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about the kind of questions that you need to be asking of your clients and asking of the agency maybe while you're planning the policy itself. And also, I think that there's an opportunity here, and I know you agree, that you can use this even before there's a written policy. You can use the directive in court to make arguments. But I want to know what kind of questions you think you need to be asking of your clients when you're starting to put together a good parenting plan the first time you're going to be in court talking about parenting time.
Sure. So I had mentioned a little bit earlier, that a lot of our clients are asked to do certain services, and sometimes it's something they need, sometimes it's not, and sometimes you can prioritize with them. So you want to make sure you are looking at the overall picture. What is their schedule like? Because I would say more times than not, they're going to have some sort of appointment, some sort of class, something at least, I would say, 3 to 4 times a week. So you need to figure out what their schedule is, and that's transparent on everyone's end, that this is what they have to do. You guys are asking them to do these things to get the kids home, so we have to keep this schedule. And then after we go through that situation, we ask them friends, relatives, any sort of support group out there that could help them with having time with their children if it is going to be in a supervised setting. So we're getting names, phone numbers, addresses of people so that we can kind of make a plan moving forward of who's going to help with the visitation, where is it going to take place, and setting a concrete schedule and putting that schedule on the record, if at all possible, so then everyone's held accountable at the next time that we meet for a report date or anything of that nature. We can go over, okay, this is what the plan was, and we can also identify if there's any issues with the plan, and we can change it moving forward. But transparency between everyone to know what everyone has going on, what the expectations are, really kind of gathering all the facts of what the barriers are. Say if there's a transportation barrier, making sure that the caseworkers are giving our client bus passes so that they can get to where they need to go.
Okay, so do you see that asking all those questions beforehand helps you prepare for the arguments that you're going to need to make in court? In your court, so do you actually make motions to improve the quality or the quantity of time that your clients are spending with their children?
Absolutely. One of the most frequent motions that we're making is a motion to move from supervised to unsupervised. And this is something that you know, you can do formally or informally. And I would recommend that we're doing this at every single stage and that you're always evaluating where is your client at with their contact with their kids from the very beginning. So, you know, you have the imminent risk hearing and whatever is established for parenting time is established. And then you're typically in court within 2 to 3 weeks. You should be talking to your client before that 2 to 3 weeks. Find out, have you had phone contact with your child or children? I think that that's one of the biggest things with regards to parenting time that slips under the radar, even with us, you know. So have that conversation about what it's looked like, what barriers they've faced, and then make these motions. Make them at each appearance. You don't want to do it frivolously. You don't want to tire the court out. If nothing has changed between one appearance and the next, then you've got to take that into consideration. But if what was set in the beginning is just completely unreasonable, then you should absolutely be challenging it. And the other thing that we talked about in our motions is, you know, it happens. We're not successful. What? Make sure that when you're not successful with your motion, that you're putting on the record why you weren't successful. Make the court put that determination out there. And then the next step is to make sure that you ask the court, you ask the caseworker, you ask the attorney for the child, what are your expectations to move my client forward? What do you want to see him or her accomplish? Or where? What kind of progress do you want to see? Is it you want to see 3 more random, you know, drug screens that are clean? Is it that you want to see the parenting class completed? Is it that you want them to have, you know, 10 domestic violence classes under their belt? Make them put that on the record so that the next time you come around and you ask, when your client has completed those things and you're ready to make your next motion, you can challenge them if they're like, nope, we're not ready. There's still concerns. Well, I'm sorry, what concerns are there? Because when we were last here, you said X, Y, and Z, and my client completed X, Y, Z, and then A, and B, and C again.
And so do you have problems getting the court to memorialize that and making that record? Are you actually putting that on the record at a conference and saying, it's my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, but the parties discussed this off the record, and this is what will happen?
And Lucy, you brought up a really good point that when I was just practicing in Article 10, I made the mistake. There's so many off-the-record conversations. That is key, that you want to memorialize it on the record. Amanda talked earlier, you know, nobody wants to think about TTR from the very beginning. But the reality is that we do have to think about TPR. And so each step of the case from the very beginning, imminent risk, I always have in the back of my mind that clock is ticking, and I want to put on the record everything to show that reasonable efforts haven't been made, that they haven't been striving to reunify these children per the goal of reunification. You constantly want to be making that record. And so what you just said, when you're having these off the record conversations, and it may be with the judge, please make sure that when you are on the record that you are reiterating. I do that all the time. I always start off by saying, Your Honor, off the record, we discussed X, Y, and Z. If the caseworker, if the county attorney, if the attorney for the child could please confirm that this is what they're looking for from my client. So yes, you absolutely want to memorialize that. Not necessarily in writing, but absolutely on the record.
Okay, so you are having an opportunity to do that, and you are doing that. And
absolutely.
And then if necessary, I guess, producing transcripts if there's some kind of dispute about what was understood at the last hearing.
Wait, Amanda and I were joking about that in the car ride up. She is the queen of pulling transcripts to hold it against people. So you have to be careful with that. Of course, our funding is limited, but you want the option there.
Yeah, right. So when you're having these hearings, you're actually presenting evidence. When you're talking about parenting time, your courts are hearing evidence, and you're having testimony offered by, I don't know, program providers?
Anyone who's witnessed the child and the parent interact, service providers, obviously bringing in if it's a substance abuse issue, any negative screens, bringing in as much documentary evidence as possible, as well as testimony. It's easier, I think, for the court to understand the progress that our clients made when they can see a number of people coming in and see their faces supporting them.
And just to bounce off of that, I think, and maybe you're going to mention this, that Amanda put together one of hers and has redacted it to provide. It was a great motion. And in addition, when we file our formal motions, we include if they've completed classes or they have negative drug screens, we include all of that as exhibits and addendums to our motions. And then we enter those things into evidence, call witnesses, because those are the people that are going to convince the court that what your client's asking for is not only reasonable, but completely makes sense in terms of working towards reunification.
Necessary to preserve
necessary.
The family.
Yes. Thank you.
And you've provided, and we have gorgeous copies of the filings from Hiscock Legal Aid Society as prepared by Amanda that we are going to distribute with this podcast. They'll be available on the New York State Office of Indigent Legal Services website and also on the New York State Defenders Association website, as well as some other materials to talk about how we can start using these policies, even if the county, the local DSS, has not formalized a written policy and distributed it yet, how we can start talking about it in terms of how often our clients are having contact with their children. Is there anything, any last thoughts for you, Angela?
Well, I did have a question and wanted to just ask Amanda and Nancy, first of all, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and insight on this. But I wanted to just switch over a little bit. We talked a little bit about relating to the client with respect to finding out information from the client and understanding the client's life and how parenting time fits into that with all the services and everything else they're trying to do. Are there other ways that you can think of that you've been able to or you might be able to use the policies and principles in this directive in counseling and advising your client at various stages of a case?
I definitely think yes, because it outlines essentially here's what everyone's goal is, and we're all hoping to get to that goal, and here's your rights, and if you have any questions further about that, we can talk about it, but it's in black and white. This is what should be happening. This is what you should expect, and if it's not happening, that we're here to do everything to assist you. And if the client is not holding up their end of the bargain, for example, it says if there's explosive behavior or something like that, the visit has to end. And you can say, okay, so here's what your rights are. Here's what the county has to provide for you. Here's what they expect in return. And we can have a bigger conversation about that.
Just jumping off of that, I think anytime that we can empower our clients who are losing so much power over their lives when their children are removed from them, you're going to give your client a little bit of hope and a light. And I think for a lot of our clients, I'm a huge proponent of making lists for clients. And like Amanda said, putting it in black and white. I mean, very simplistic lists, 1, 2, 3, 4, or check marks for them. And I think, you know, the policy itself is probably a little heavy for a lot of our clients, but I would encourage people to break it down into something that their clients can understand and make it a checklist for them, because I think the more that they have something to turn to that can give them that timeline or the steps that they have to take, the more empowered they're going to feel and the more comfortable they're going to feel with knowing what's happening. And just slightly off topic with that, we just talked about timelines. Amanda started this and I followed suit, and I think it was great. I encourage attorneys to try to get the county to nail down a timeline, especially when your client is really making progress and doing well. Okay, what needs to be accomplished in this next month? Then we're gonna have unsupervised. And then how many times do we have to have unsupervised before we go to overnights? And then how many overnights before we go to return? Because again, that kind of stuff gives our clients power because they see something concrete to look at rather than this, you know, nebulous idea that they just can't grasp and they feel more out of control.
Thank you so much for bringing up that aspect of this whole relationship in terms of the power dynamic and what parent attorneys can do to help their clients maintain and reclaim some power over what's happening to them in this very, you know, crisis-ridden time of their lives. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing with us your materials and your wisdom and the work that you have done to try to make this as understandable and easy as you can for your clients. I also want to point out for our podcast audience that you can hear from both Amanda and Nancy if you attend the Families Matter Conference, which will be in Albany in April 20 and 21. It's a parent defender conference. It's for statewide public defense attorneys. That does include 18B attorneys as well. And they'll be presenting at that conference as speakers. Thank you so much. Until next time. Try everything.